to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig this Wednesday, the 25th of September. You're listening to KPFT HD channel 90.1-3. I believe you're entitled to your own opinion, but not your own facts. And always remember, you can listen to KPFT, listen to this show rather, on kpft.org. On demand, you can listen to it online at kpft.org, listen live. It's not horribly complicated, but it can be a little tricky. Also, you can visit my website at thinkwingradio.com, or if you just like shortcuts, you can do thinkwing.org. That actually works. Some interesting things today. This is going to be one of those shows where I'm just not sure if I have way too much to do, or I'm going to think I have way too much to do, and then I'm going to run short. But we're going to find that out. This weekend, if you recall last Wednesday, I interviewed Mae Jemison and Carl Aspelund on the 100-Year Starship Symposium. It's a project that was started by Mae Jemison, a former NASA astronaut. If you ever look at her bio, she is a definite overachiever. And it was really interesting. I got to go on a press pass, which is great, because otherwise I probably couldn't have afforded to, because I'm poor and cheap. The objective of the symposium is to investigate technologies. I mean, we're talking beyond cutting edge, beyond bleeding edge. These are technologies that literally are kind of in your dreams, but not necessarily impossible. And, you know, there's an old saying that the improbable we do all day long, the impossible just takes a little longer. So you've got to start somewhere. And the title of the symposium was Pathway to the Stars, Footprints on Earth. And there was actually some discussion during the symposium about the title that they chose for it, because there was a lot of discussion that's really very, very appropriate. Because you can't do this kind of research in a vacuum and expect to get support for it. So the question is, what kinds of sciences and technologies and social insights are necessary to accomplish literally a starship that can be built by the year 2112, while at the same time being able to translate the benefits of that incrementally to people to live on, for people to live on Earth? I mean, that's necessary both for the betterment of humanity and also in practical terms just for continuing political and economic support. The 100-Year Starship is a joint project of the Defense Department through DARPA and also NASA. It looks at a number of things. For example, among the topics that were discussed at the symposium were methods of propulsion and communications across vast distances. So, you know, right now we use radio. And the radio, the strength of the radio signals that reach the Earth are sometimes less than a watt. So they broadcast at maybe some ridiculously low power, like 23 watts. And by the time they've crossed space, it might be a watt or less. Those kinds of things need massive antennas. You've got to filter out the noise. It's really amazing what we take for granted that, as Arthur C. Clarke said, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. And that's true of so many things that we take for granted today. So this notion of propulsion and communications. Well, communications, aside from radio, there is laser. They have talked about using other kinds of waves. Propulsion. Rocket propulsion is problematic. It has taken about 35 years for the Voyager 2 spacecraft to get from Earth to literally now interstellar space. It's gotten beyond the heliosphere and now is traveling in what is believed from the data being sent back to actually be interstellar space. With some of the newer technologies that we have on the horizon, it might be possible. I think it's something like 8.7 billion miles, something on that order. And I think with the technologies they have now, they're saying that we might be able to get to that same point within 15 to 18 years. So we have doubled, in 35 years, we have doubled the technological capability to get to that point in space. But at the current rate of speed, Voyager 2, if it were aimed in the right direction, would take 50,000 years to get to the nearest star. That's literally longer than human history, longer than human prehistory. It's almost as long as humanity has been the species we are. So that's a really long time. So even if we could double that speed, you're still looking at 25,000 years, which is still five times longer than written history. So we have a ways to go. But, you know, there's a whole lot that we can do with better propulsion between here and, say, Alpha Centauri. If we could achieve great speeds, we could get to Mars in the span of time that it used to take to get from Europe to North America. That would already be an achievement. That was a several-month trip. That was what they did. We're kind of in the neighborhood of being able to do that. So anyway, not to dwell too much on that one aspect. So there's the propulsion and communications aspect. Another area of discussion was the effects of microgravity, or some people call it improperly zero gravity, on human health and metabolism, the psychological problems associated with basically isolation, diminishing contact between humans in a spaceship and friends, family, and support staff on the Earth, and design prototyping of life support and agricultural systems for extended space habitation and travel. As we discussed last week, interstellar travel or interplanetary travel sounds really romantic, but you still can't get away without doing the laundry. So, very pragmatic things. You have to bathe, you have to shower, you have to eliminate waste. Things like extraneous noise that can drive you crazy. The International Space Station is actually a very noisy craft, and your brain just has to tune it out. But that isn't to say it doesn't affect your psychology or even your physical well-being. So, things like textiles, how they're used, how they're worn, how they're cleaned, how much cleaning they require. Are you able to produce any of your own food? How would that food be recycled? I mean, there are just so many different aspects, and they sound awfully theoretical and awfully esoteric, but they have actually potentially very great applications on Earth. I mean, on Earth, we need to know how people can get along better in very compact communities. In a spaceship, you've got a small number of people in a very confined space where tempers can run high and compatibility matters. How do these people get along for months in a very confined space where you can't escape each other? Well, there are cities on this planet that have 25 million people, and they're tripping over each other all the time. So understanding the psychology and sociology of groups that essentially have no privacy, that is something to which we have direct application. When you talk about things like doing laundry, doing cleaning, doing it in a way that conserves water, that minimizes chemical contamination, that doesn't use materials or chemicals that can impact human or environmental health. In a spacecraft where you have an isolated ecology, I mean, it is an ecology, it's just a really, really small one, you need to develop ways of doing these things that don't impact the other creatures in the ecology, which is primarily the humans. So, and growing food in limited space with limited resources, again, this is something that has direct application to areas that have trouble not only growing food, but the storage of food. I have read that if all the food grown didn't spoil, nobody would go hungry. Because in much of the world, they do not have appropriate storage facilities. A lot of grains and harvests are stored out in the open. They're susceptible to moisture. They're susceptible to mold. They're susceptible to varmints. and an enormous, I mean, we're not just talking about the food that people take, bite half an apple, eat half an apple, and then throw it away. That's waste. But the other kind of waste is sort of unavoidable waste, waste that's based on the kinds of infrastructures we have for storing and moving and utilizing food products. So all of these studies, while they have a very distant, almost incomprehensible objective, building a spacecraft that can go to another star system in the next 100 years, but everything that we need to do in order to accomplish that goal has direct and indirect applications on Earth to the average human, in some cases more important to people who are poor than people who are rich, has direct applications. So this is a really very serious subject. I actually had a really good time. I went to the World Science Fiction Convention the last week of August, and I have to tell you, I actually had a better time at the symposium than I had at the World Science Fiction Convention. I don't know if it's because this is more reality-based, because there is a lot of reality, technological reality discussed at World Science Fiction Conventions. A lot of very bright people at the symposium. That's also true at science fiction conventions. Maybe the people at the symposium weren't as socially awkward as many of the people at the science fiction convention, among whom, by the way, I probably should include myself. But in any case, if they'll probably have this symposium annually. This is the second one, I believe, or the third one they've had. This is the third one. The first one was in 2011. And I don't know if they're going to change cities, but they'll probably have this again about this time next year. I will try to go. I would suggest many of you out there might be interested in going. On my website, I've got a number of links from last week's show that would give you information on the 100-year starship. It's 100yss.org. Is an easy way to get there. Again, I've got the links on the September 18th show at the bottom of that post, and I'll probably repost them when I write up this show. So, 100-year starship. Really, really exciting concept. They even did an article on it. Well, they've done a number of articles on it. In The Guardian, they did an article called NASA Hosts the Starship Project Aiming for Interstellar Travel Within 100 Years. Well, how much accuracy can you get into a headline? But it's in the neighborhood. Let's see. When they talk, this was kind of interesting, and then I'm going to move on to another topic. Someone here is quoted as saying, we have a starship. They're referring now to the Voyager, which is an interstellar space. We have a starship, and it's 36 years old. So that's really good. It's not as impossible as it sounds. Where the challenge becomes ludicrous and really astounding is the distances from one star to another. Voyager 1, at its current speed, if it was pointed in the right direction, which it isn't, would take 50,000 years to get to the next star, and this is the fastest thing humanity has ever built. So we have a little ways to go. But we've actually taken the first baby step. Okay, let's do a quick station ID before I move on to the next topic. This is KPFT HD 90.1-3. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig. I've got Clarice McPherson helping me at the control board, which she's been doing every week now for the last several weeks and occasionally indispensably. And, of course, the website is thinkwingradio.com, or if you're just sort of lazy and in a hurry, thinkwing.org will also work. Second Amendment. This is like a topic that we can't get away from. It's every time we turn around, there's a new random shooting, a new mass shooting, a new shooting by someone who has mental problems. So this time it was in Washington, D.C. Now, we've had a lot of trouble getting any kind of legislation passed on a state level, let alone a federal level, on, let's call it regulation, because that's kind of what it actually is, on regulation of guns. The conflict with the Second Amendment, as worded and as punctuated, makes gun control, gun regulation legislation, really, really hard. And I'm going to read it. And the thing is, there are several different versions of this when it was first being promulgated among the states, when it was first being voted for ratification among the states, when it was actually put into the Constitution by the Congress. There are like three different versions of this with different different upper and lower cases. Some things are capitalized, some things are not. There's commas in some places and semicolons in others. It really has a very checkered history as far as accuracy goes from one translation to another. But the final version, apparently, that is worked on in the Constitution is the one that is passed by Congress. A well-regulated militia, comma, being necessary to the security of a free state, state being uppercase, it's not always, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, comma, shall not be infringed. That's a whole lot of commas. The commas create lots of questions. I'd have to say in my dreams, because this is probably not going to happen, but in my dreams, I'm starting to think that we need to amend the Second Amendment. It's overly broad, it's very vague, it's poorly written, and it's poorly punctuated. And to say it's poorly punctuated is not to sort of just be an anal grammarian. It's poorly punctuated in a way that lawyers have problems with. Punctuation means something. There is a version where it says a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, semicolon. That starts to mean a different thing. So, you know, I think that given the changes in technology, I've made the comment in the past that when the Second Amendment was conceived and written and passed, for someone to fire 50 rounds in rapid succession, you had to carry 50 loaded guns with you. You had one gun, you had one round, and then if you were good, it took about a minute to reload the one gun. And now you can fire 60 rounds a second. You can fire, I mean, even a semi-automatic, you can get off 60 rounds a minute, just as many times as you can pull the trigger if you have enough bullets in the weapon. So is it crazy to think about amending the Second Amendment? Well, we live in an environment right now, and maybe it's always like this, just we don't think about it because we're sort of locked into our own little lifetimes. But we're living in a time when there's just a lot of really strange ideas out there about guns and government and the Second Amendment. But, you know, sometimes I think maybe if we were to rewrite the Second Amendment, I think we could do worse than to take out the first comma. That would actually make a difference in terms of legal interpretation. Maybe take out the last comma. Yeah, I'm not sure if that would be a good thing or a bad thing. Maybe make a distinction between military arms and arms intended for self-defense. Maybe make a limit of 45 caliber for personal weapons. You know, when you write an amendment, I think an amendment usually is not written like legislation. It's written more like a political platform plank, where the idea is to clearly define the concept you have in mind and then allow legislators to do what they will in terms of interpreting it for individual communities, individual states, and occasionally under federal law. Now, what's kind of interesting as an aside, when you talk about amending, anytime you talk about amending the Constitution, there are actually two ways to initiate an amendment to the Constitution. The most common method, the method that most people, to the extent that they know, is for Congress to pass a proposed congressional amendment by a two-thirds vote and then submit it to the states. And when two-thirds of the state legislatures, which I think now is 34 states, 35 states, when two-thirds of the state legislatures have ratified that amendment becomes part of the Constitution. To the extent that I am correct in my summation, and it's really close if not on, there is an alternative method. If two-thirds of state legislatures call for Congress to pass an amendment to the Constitution, that's another way to go, and that's called an Article 5 convention, based on Article 5 in the Constitution. Apparently, in recent history, meaning in my lifetime, there have been at least two attempts to call an Article 5 convention that ultimately were preempted by Congress by passing the amendment that apparently, or at least putting into legislation for approval or disapproval by the states, to basically head off an Article 5 convention. There are certain constitutional things that you hear a lot of politicians in different branches of government arguing about. Does the Congress have too much power to do this, or does the executive to have too much power to do that? Have you ever wondered why none of these parties ever bring it to the Supreme Court to make a final decision? I mean, wouldn't that make sense? You have Congress groaning and moaning about, oh, the president is too free to make war and deploy military forces. And the president says, well, I'm the commander-in-chief. I have the right to do that. This is something that could very easily be brought up before the Supreme Court. It isn't. It hasn't been. It won't be. And the reason is it's one of those dynamic tensions in our government that really nobody wants resolved, because it is the dynamic tension, the lack of a final judicial resolution in some of these questions, that is really where the politics happens, where the negotiation happens. If this went to court and the president won, he would have unfettered power to make war effectively, even though he wouldn't be able to declare war. That's Congress, but that would be irrelevant. He'd have just unlimited power to make war. On the other hand, if Congress won, the president would have the power to do virtually nothing. His power to make war would be very, very circumscribed. So the flexibility in not knowing is the reason it's never been brought to court. So getting back to something like amending the Second Amendment, you could have an Article 5 convention called for. But another question that comes up, if you had enough state legislatures, so you might have a whole bunch of conservative legislatures that go, no, 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 we don't want it. But if you could get two-thirds of the states with sufficiently liberal legislatures or governments so that they can get past a call for a constitutional amendment or a reconsideration of the Second Amendment, here's the next catch. The Constitution does not make clear whether such a convention would be limited to the one amendment for which it is called. You may recall that under the Articles of Confederacy, which didn't work very well, it was decided that they would go to Philadelphia and try to tinker with the Articles of Confederation. This is like 1787, that they would try to tinker with the Articles of Confederation to make the federal government a little more powerful, to make the states a little less like separate countries, to talk about things like control of standing armies and who has the right to muster armies and taxes and tariffs. And when they got there, they ultimately decided that the Articles of Confederation were so flawed that they just threw them out and started over, and we ended up with a Constitution. Now, our history tells us that was a good thing. I'm not so sure it would be a good thing to do now. And interestingly, this is one of the few areas where the far left and the far right and pretty much everyone in between agrees. They don't necessarily agree for the same reasons, but they all seem to agree that a constitutional convention would be the worst possible outcome of any effort by the states to call an Article 5 convention. Because the liberals are afraid that the conservatives will turn us into a fascist state, and they'll modify the free speech, and they'll modify the separation of church and state, and everybody will be required to own a gun. And, I mean, just your worst nightmare. On the other hand, the conservatives are afraid that guns will be taken out of their hands, and police will be able to do all kinds of things that civil libertarians are scared to death of, and the Fifth Amendment will start to run crazy and you'll never be able to convict a criminal. Not all of these objections are rational, But the important thing is everybody is scared to death of a constitutional convention. So this is kind of among the constraints within we are operating practically and legally and constitutionally speaking. But boy, I wish we could amend the Second Amendment. It's one of those things we can wish for, and maybe one of those things we should open our minds to in order to create a new environment then for state and local regulation.
Wow.
Awesome. Because we're not looking at the United States passing an amendment to take away your guns. I think that there's a large population in this country that has a reasonable desire and need for guns. You know, if you're living out in an isolated part of Wyoming where the nearest policeman is half an hour away, maybe by helicopter, you might need to have weapons. So, you know, different environments call for different circumstances. But I think it's something that we need to consider aside from just passing laws in like little bits and pieces and testing them against the Second Amendment. You know, it's just becoming very, very difficult. Messy. Yes, Glorice, messy. That sums it up nicely. Simple is sometimes better. You are listening to KPFT 90.1 HD Channel 3, so that's 90.1-3 on your HD radio dial if you're among the approximately half a dozen people in Houston that have HD radios. Or you can listen live online at kpft.org. Listen live is the button. Or you can listen after the show has aired by going to kpft.org on demand. And then you can sort for Think Wing Radio, and all of the shows within like the last 60 days, I believe, are archived there. And of course, I eventually, sooner or sometimes later, post them on my website where I have stuff going back to my first show in May of 2010 on a different station. ThinkWingRadio.com or ThinkWing.org, that is where you go for my pontificating. I have to say, do you want to know what the most popular article on my website is? It's so ironic. You know, I have all of these ideas that I talk about, all my ideas on politics and all my ideas on technology. And the most popular thing on my website is how to put monochrome graphs back into Excel 2007.
Okay.
It is the least likely thing you would expect to find on my site. I mean, my site is eclectic. It's not just politics. But technical advice on Excel 2007, and the story of how that happened is actually kind of interesting. My wife, who is a researcher, was putting together an article for publication, and it's more expensive. You pay them to publish your article. It's a little bit like a vanity press, but that's oversimplifying. And it costs more to have your article published in color with color figures, color graphics. So typically what you want to do is have monochrome graphics with like cross hatching and shading and bigger and smaller dots in order to distinguish all these different things in monochrome. And at the time she was working with Office 2007, and for some weird reason, Office 2003, I'm going to say Excel 2003 and Excel 2010 both have this capability. And for some inexplicable reason that no one I have heard understands, it's just not there in 2007. Maybe they forgot it? I don't know. So there are a couple of free apps, add-ons, that you can apply to Excel in order to add that capability. They're hard to find. And once you find them, they're a little hard to implement. So being my wife's in-home technical support, she came to me one night, a couple of years ago, and said, can you figure out a way to do this? So I did some research, and I figured out how to do it, and I put it in her computer, and that was that. And then she said, could you write this down so that the people in my lab can add it to their machines? So I wrote a long piece with very, very detailed instructions on how to add the add-ons, and that there are two different add-ons you can choose, and they have different advantages and disadvantages. And after I had spent a couple of hours writing this, after having spent a couple of additional hours researching it, I decided, you know what, I've already got this thing written. There have to be other people out there with the same problem. why don't I just revise it slightly so that it's an article instead of a personal instruction and post it out there just for whoever might need it. Since that posting, that, it hasn't been anything I've talked about FDR or the space program or cat videos or anything else,
politicians,
snark. It has been the single most popular thing by far. And any given week, probably one-third of the hits at my website, and I get something like 100 hits a day, about one-third of the hits on any given day are people searching for a way to put this add-on into Windows 2007. It is not only the most accessed thing on my website, it is the most commented thing on my website. I get very few comments on other articles and postings. This one, it's always like, oh my God, thank you so much for this. I have been going crazy trying to figure out how to do this. I mean, this is generally the tone of the comments. I think there are at least a dozen or more comments. And it's wonderful. It makes me feel really good that this work that I did specifically for my wife and her lab has ended up being so helpful to so many other people. But on the other hand, it's really kind of annoying. Because it's like, I'm more than just my Excel article. You know, it's like a woman saying, up here, my face. Anyway. All right. Moving on to more serious topics. NJ.com, a New Jersey news site, had this article, which apparently came from the Associated Press, property tax burden up 13% under Chris Christie, AP analysis shows. Now, of course, as a liberal, I had some initial delight in the headlines. Like, yeah, because they talk about no taxes, and there he is raising property taxes, which are flat taxes, which I'm going to get into in a moment. But to be fair, when you dig into the article, apparently this is a problem that has occurred during both Christie, who was a Republican, and Corzine, who was a Democrat. And New Jersey has just had a real problem kind of balancing how to tax versus what to spend tax money on. So I can't be too tough on Christie about this. What I do want to point out, though, is, and again, I repeat myself occasionally, conservatives, when they talk about fair taxes and tax reform to make taxes fairer, what they always mean in the subtext is, we want a flat tax. We want a flat tax. We want everybody to pay the same tax rate regardless of their income. That's what Republicans and conservatives mean when they say we want fair taxes, we want tax reform. Now, what struck me as interesting, and again, I'm not specifically going to go after Chris Christie on this because it is a complicated article. But it is worth noting that when you look at the kinds of things that have been used to finance government entities, increasingly they are fees. Mm-hmm. So it's a toll road fee. It's a license fee. It's a car registration fee. Now, some of these are so old that we don't even think about them. It's like, yeah, well, car registration, it's a fee. It's based on the car. To some extent, I mean, if you think about this, to some extent, actually, a car registration, because it is based on the size and weight of the vehicle, trucks, of course, being the heaviest, in most counties, in most states, that registration fee is based on a thing like the weight of the vehicle, because that determines how much wear and tear it puts on infrastructure. So to some extent, you could make a case that it is a somewhat progressive fee structure or tax structure, because presumably people that can afford bigger, heavier vehicles have the income or the wealth or the business need that supports that vehicle, and that people that can't support big vehicles buy smaller vehicles and therefore typically are supposed to pay smaller registration fees. So there's even some progressivity in vehicle registration. Now, to my knowledge, property taxes, for the most part, are flat. Mm-hmm. Now, you can get allowances. You know, you can get a homestead exemption, you can get a disability exemption, you can get a retirement age exemption, you can get an agricultural exemption. But for the most part, a property is appraised, and the appraisal sets a value, and the value is then taxed at a very specific rate, some percentage of the appraised value of the property. Now, the exemptions are the exemptions, but the appraisal and the tax rate, that's a flat tax. So sales tax is a flat tax. It's regressive. It's income independent. Property taxes are flat taxes. They are regressive. They are income independent. Toll roads are flat taxes. They're a user fee, but they're flat. They are income independent. If you can't afford the toll, you use the frontage road, or as I used to call it up in the Northeast, the service road. And you get to stop at traffic lights because you're not good enough to get on a road without traffic lights because you don't have the money. So anytime you hear someone talking about, especially a Republican, especially a conservative, when you hear them talking about, we need to reform the tax system so it's fairer, what they mean is they want you to pay the same tax rate as Romney. They have been trying to kill progressivity since the income tax was passed in the early 20th century and made progressive. So that's the thing that came to mind under that particular article. Another article I ran across, city, meaning Houston, underfunding employee pensions. I'm just going to take a couple little pieces out of that article. It's actually, it was on myfoxhouston.com. Again, I will post a link, pretty much anything that I mention on this show. If there was a link that I referred to, I generally post it. I just have come to feel like that's a good thing that I can do to help enhance whatever informational value I provide. Houston Fox 26. It almost hurts me that it wasn't more liberal source. But in any case, the city of Houston has promised more money to retiring municipal workers than it's been willing to save. That's the opening sentence. For every $5 we pay in taxes, theoretically, one should go to fully fund employee pensions. In other words, for every $5 in taxes, 20% of the city's tax revenue should be going to fully fund employee pensions. The problem is nobody has been doing that. The last three administrations have not been doing that. So according to Elena Farah, a senior fellow for public financial sustainability at the University of Houston's Hobby Center for Public Policy, quote, there has not been sufficient money set aside to pay for those pensions. There is a retired firefighter by the name of Jimmy Carroll, fought fires in Houston for 33 years, retired a few months ago, and he feels like it's a betrayal that, in this case, Mayor Anise Parker, but also prior mayors, have been trying to balance the city budget on the back of, in his case, firefighters. Ms. Farah of the Public Policy Center contends that unless the city redirects current revenue or raises fresh cash for new taxes, it simply cannot afford to pay the, and I use her word here, generous cost of living increases promised retired firefighters and their families years ago. She believes it's time for the kind of compromising that could help, that could have helped save Detroit from going bust. These kinds of articles drive me crazy. Not because I feel like retired workers are getting overpaid. But you have to remember the context in which these pensions were negotiated. These pensions were negotiated in lieu of pay increases. These pensions were negotiated in lieu of medical benefits. So what the governments, whether it's the city or the state or the county or whatever, what the governments were saying at the time these things were negotiated 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago, were, you know, we really don't have the money to pay you those wages now, but we promise that when you retire, you'll be in good shape. So now let's consider this. If you don't get a wage increase, it affects your pension. It affects your Social Security. It affects many other ancillary benefits that you get in retirement. It's kind of the same thing as wage discrimination against women. It's not just that they are not paid as much as men. It's that they don't retire with as much as men because it's all income-based. So when someone says, it's high time for the kind of compromising that could have helped save Detroit from going bust, my response tends to be no. Much sooner than this, somebody should have taken these governments to court and said, you need to be funding the pensions at the rate you agreed because we waived pay increases in order to get these so-called generous benefits.
Wow.
It's cheating. It takes the idea of a contract and turns it on its head. Any lawyer, any contract lawyer, now I'm not a lawyer, so I endanger myself a little by speaking for them. But I would imagine that any contract lawyer is driven nuts by this kind of logic. That you enter into a contract almost with the expectation that 30 years down the road you're just going to renegotiate it because you can't meet it. So, that's one of my things that's annoying me today. Bill Gates is buying one of Houston's most prominent hotels in downtown, the Houston Four Seasons. I just ran across that this morning when I was getting ready for the show. And the snarkiest things that I could come up with is that since they're going to remodel it, we can assume that the new beds will be Microsoft. And your room key will only need about 1 minute to boot the lock.
Bill Gates.
Bill Gates, Microsoft. Maybe it's funny, maybe it's not. WikiLeaks, back in the news because somebody's making a movie. Somebody is making a movie about WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. The international organization, which regularly, this is from movies.msn.com, again, I'll have the link posted at some point. The international organization, which regularly releases classified or sensitive information to the public, has leaked a, quote, mature version of the script, accompanied with a lengthy memo explaining why Bill Condon's film, Bill Condon being, I guess, the producer or director, is irresponsible, this is their quote, irresponsible, counterproductive, and harmful. This is WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks is accusing someone who's making a movie of being irresponsible, counterproductive, and harmful. I think WikiLeaks is irony deprived. Let's see. Among the complaints, they say the film tells only one side of the story because it's based on two books written by people who had personal and legal disputes with the activist organization. Let's see. These are personally biased sources and outdated by 3 years. Now, I mean, when you read these kinds of things, it's like, so when they did the biopic on Christopher Columbus, it's inaccurate because it's out of date by 400 years.
400 years.
Actually, it's inaccurate just because it's inaccurate. The time element has nothing to do with it. I call docudramas faux history. I try not to watch docudramas. I try not to watch so-called biographical films because they always take creative license. They always take dramatic license. And even going in knowing that, your perception of the reality ends up being twisted on some very subtle subliminal level.
Yes.
So I actually think, and I've had this discussion previously with actually a historian. He didn't make as big a deal of it as I do, but, well, you know, different minds. So anyhow, I guess the point I wanted to make is WikiLeaks, man, what a bunch of crybabies. They steal, and I don't think there's any other word for it. You know, you can talk about whatever justification you like, but they steal millions of government documents or are accessories to the stealing of millions of government documents, some of which you could argue have done serious harm to our diplomatic relations, our international policies. I'm not going to argue whether there was any good or justification, whether there were any war crimes that may have been revealed. it's not an unanointed bad, what they did, but it's a lot of bad. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these guys are saying, how could you get it wrong? We are entitled to have you make a movie about the whole truth. And it's like, don't they understand the concept of a docudrama? They're never accurate. Ever. There's always creative license taken. Now, my personal opinion, if you want to argue about this movie, they should just sort of visualize what it would have looked like if it had been made by Oliver Stone. Oliver Stone has never found a historical event that he can't reimagine. So, you know, maybe they should count their blessings. You know, Julian Assange could have been cast with an albino because he's so fair-skinned, and people make such a thing out of the fact that he's so fair-skinned and his hair is so blondy-blonde. And it's like, you know, count your blessings, guys. Just the less you talk about it, maybe the better off you are. Because no matter how much you complain about this movie, in 5 years, when it goes on Netflix, nobody's going to read anything you say. They're just going to watch the movie, which is the problem with docudramas. You can make all the side commentary you want, and at the end of the day, it just doesn't matter. Okay, next to the last thing I'll be talking about today, traffic. Traffic. It brought to mind an article that I read based on a study from 2007. Mathematicians from the University of Exeter in the UK, along with universities in Bristol and Budapest, claim to have solved the mystery of traffic jams by developing a model to show how major delays occur on roads with no apparent cause. Goes on to say, many traffic jams leave drivers baffled as they finally reach the end of a tailback. Isn't that a lovely term for traffic jam? To find no visible cause for their delay, now a team of mathematicians have found the answer. The model revealed that slowing down below a critical speed when reacting to an event forces the driver behind to slow down even further and the next car back to reduce it even further. And the result is that you have this chain reaction going back for several miles where things literally come to a halt. And another aspect of this that I have read in a different article, which I thought was amusing, and I did a quick search for it but couldn't quite find it. The conclusion of the article, and I think it was based on this study, was that 20% of traffic that 100% of traffic problems are caused by 20% of drivers. Okay. So when you complain, that stupid driver, he's got 15 car lengths in front of him, he's a moving traffic jam, you're right. That person is part of the problem. Don't be that person. That's why I sometimes end the show with slower traffic, keep right. It's not just a good idea. It's the law. It's in the handbook, in the Texas Driver's License Handbook. Let's see. And then they go on, when you tap the brake, cars may come someday equipped with new electronic devices which could cut down on overbraking as a result of slow reactions. Wow. Folks, think about the way you drive. I mean, seriously, think about the way you drive. Don't be oblivious. Keep an eye on what's going on in front of you. Honest to gosh, at 15 miles an hour, you don't need five car lengths in front of you.
What about the people who text and drive?
The people in who?
Text and drive.
The Texan drivers?
Yeah, they text.
Oh, texting drivers. Texting drivers. You know, I think one of the worst things I've ever seen, back in like 1977, maybe, when I first moved to Houston, I had a job that got me up really early. Got me up at a time that normally these days I go to sleep. And, you know, people drive. Since I've been retired, it's like people drive like maniacs in the morning. Just insane. I'm amazed that more... Yes, that's the story I'm going to tell. Glorice is doing the eye makeup thing. I was literally driving on 610. I was heading east on 610. It was probably about 5:45 in the morning. And there was a woman in front of me. And honest to gosh, it was a woman. I'm not being sexist here. There was a woman in front of me who's driving at 65 miles an hour while leaning in front of her rear view mirror, literally putting on eye makeup. At 65 miles an hour, at 5:45 in the morning, when you know she's wide awake, And you know that everybody around her is wide awake, and nobody's in a hurry, and therefore it's a perfectly safe thing to do. I have driven my wife to the airport. Sometimes she goes to conferences around the world, and sometimes I have to get her to the airport by like 6 or 7 in the morning so that she can make her plane. And my God, these people are driving like lunatics. I don't know how I got out alive when I used to have to drive to work. I don't know how I got out alive. Okay, well, the last thing I want to talk about, unless it turns out that it doesn't take up enough time, the last thing I want to talk about is we apparently are entering the fall holiday season. I can tell because the stores are rearranging their seasonal aisles. We are now in the holiday period that I have come to call Hallow Thanks Christmaka. There was a time when they would... Now, keep in mind, it isn't October yet. It isn't even October yet, and Halloween is the 31st of October. It is... They've already... Well, they started like a week ago. It's now September 25th. I was already noticing this a week ago. They've already cleared out the summer stuff, and now they're putting up Santa Clauses alongside Halloween witches. So you've got the scary sounds on the battery-operated Halloween decorations. You've got Santa going up. You've got some turkey things going in. You've got costumes going in. It really has become just a single 3-month-long holiday shopping period. So you've got Halloween, which is the 31st. You've got Thanksgiving, which is, I believe, the fourth Thursday in November. Then you've got Christmas, which is December 25th. And then you've got Hanukkah, which floats around and only matters if you're Jewish, have Jewish friends, or simply want to have an excuse for another gift-giving holiday or gift-receiving holiday, as the case may be. Hanukkah being the Jewish holiday on the lunar calendar, so it tends to drift, sometimes has a happy coincidence of
7 days.
7 days. Well, you know, what is it, 10 days of Christmas? On the first day of Christmas. Is it 10 days, 12 days?
12 days.
So you figure between Christmas and Hanukkah, if it's timed out just right with the two calendars, you could actually have a whole month of gifts, which probably gets, I mean, aside from the expense and the challenge, most people have already given up and gone with gift certificates. So what do you get? You get 20 or 30 gift certificates. It's just greed. It's just greed. Do me a favor. Pop on track 29. Just turn that on. Because I wanted to get the underscore here. I forgot to do the underscore. Let's get some volume on there so we can hear it underneath. I love this song. A little too loud because I'm still talking. Back it off a little. Back it off a little. A little more. A little more. A little more. It's just subtext. Okay. So we're talking about, I mean, just holidays. I remember when I was a kid and all these holidays were really separate. And that kind of made them special. And now we have just gotten to the point where it's all about the money and the seasonal aisles, and they only want to do the aisles once, and it just annoys me. So I'll tell you what I'm going to do, because this is one of my favorite pieces of music. It's by Danny Elfman. Danny Elfman is a brilliant contemporary composer of music scores. He used to be in the group Oingo Boingo and has broken out as one of the great composers. He does a very eclectic kind of stuff, a distinctive style. But very eclectic stuff, from The Nightmare Before Christmas to Batman Returns and Elizabeth Claiborne and Dead Presidents. And, I mean, he just does some brilliant, brilliant stuff. What I love about this piece, this is the theme to the movie Nightmare Before Christmas. But it is not the soundtrack theme. This is actually kind of a little bonus track on this particular CD. It's the demo piece that he made to pitch his score to the people, to Tim Burton, I guess, making the movie. Tim Burton was the producer and director of this film, I believe. So what's kind of fun is he does most of the voices. He actually ended up doing the voice of Jack Skeleton, was it? Jack, the Pumpkinhead King. He ended up doing the voice and doing the singing for that character, but this is him doing a lot of the voices, which in the movie are actually done by many, many different voice actors. So what we're going to do right now, I'm going to shut up and let you listen to this. I really, really want you to listen to the lyrics. I'm not a lyric guy, but for Hallow Thanks Christmaka, this is the song I want to start with. Listen to the lyrics. They're very, very fast, but they're a lot of fun. Let's go ahead and restart 29, and then I'm going to shut up, and we're going to listen to it play. Played that enough times where I can catch all the really quick lyric, I sing along with it in my car where I can't embarrass myself too much. Okay, we're pretty much at the top of the hour, so we're going to start playing out on track three. Are we set up? There we go. So this has been a fun show. One of these days I may do at least part of a show on some of the film music and TV music that I really, really love and some of the interesting people behind it. Bernard Herrmann is the guy that I really want to do someday because he has such an enormous body of work that's fabulous, and he died really fairly young. But great stuff. Anyway, thanks so much for taking the time to listen. This is Mike Koenig, Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1-3 HD. You can listen at thinkwingradio.com, thinkwing.org. You can visit my blog, and eventually I post all my shows there along with whatever other stuff I decide is interesting. And, of course, you can go to kpft.org and listen on demand or listen to programming live. Have a great day, and I'll speak to you next week.